Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Hey. Marky.
Thank you, Rerun. Welcome to the show.
I don't know what brought that on. Hi, everybody. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
We're in the business of truth-telling today.
Truth-telling. We're always in the business of truth-telling.
And, you know, I think I like being able to talk about stuff like this because there were a few things that came across my desk over the weekend, and I think that they came across your desk, too. I forwarded them to you. Here's an interesting controversy. It seems as though the Center for Science and the Public Interest, which, you know, sort of writes about, they're kind of doomsdayers, they're pretty good science, but they write about how this food is bad for you and that food is bad for you and all the different foods that are bad for you, and then you wind up eating just lettuce.
Which is bad for you.
Which
it's covered with E. coli, and it's very bad. Stop eating lettuce.
So, and then you die. Don't eat anything. No, but I mock them, but they do very valuable research about, and they tell us a lot about the foods that we eat and the chemicals that we're surrounded with. But the Center for Science and the Public Interest, they did a study that showed the unhealthiness of Chinese food. Now, it wasn't exactly Chinese food. It was the typical Chinese restaurant, okay? The typical Chinese restaurant menu, here's a quote. The typical Chinese restaurant is a sea of nutritional no-nos, the Center for Science and the Public Interest has found. A plate of General Tso's chicken, for example, is loaded with about 40% more sodium and more than half the calories an average adult needs for an entire day. Now, there are people who are detracting from this, right? There are people who are saying this study by the Center for Science and the Public Interest is ridiculous because the restaurant you find in an American Chinese restaurant is not the food that the Chinese eat. It's not real Chinese food.
For the most part, those Chinese-American restaurants, is how they should be dubbed, have nothing to do with food from China.
And frankly, have nothing to do with what Chinese people eat in America or what you can find in a really good Chinatown if you know how to order off the menu. So the criticism of the study that says that Chinese restaurant food is bad for you is that, well, it's not real Chinese food. But who cares?
But right, that's what we eat.
Right.
You know, I mean, realize that most people who go to Chinese restaurants in this country are going to these Chinese American restaurants where this is the food they're being served.
Right. But
let me give you a little duh, okay? If 40% of the food you're eating comes out of the deep fryer, it's probably not good for you.
And there aren't that many deep fryers in China.
Okay.
You know, but what's funny is they're saying, oh, well, the Center for Science and the Public Interest is saying that Chinese food is bad for you, but it's not real Chinese food. But it's the Chinese food that most people eat. They're not giving advice to travelers on their way to China not to eat the local food when they get there. You know,
beware
what I mean?
Of the bamboo shoots. They're terrible.
So, and it says, well, here's one of the criticisms. What most people in the U.S. encounter at a strip mall hole in the wall will be pretty unrecognizable to what Chinese eat in China or even a proper Chinatown. And right.
Yes, of course. Of course, of course. Hold on. Of course, it gets two of courses. That's how silly that is.
So what we need to be careful about is that this study is that the Center for Science and the Public Interest, their study is about Chinese food as you will probably get it at your
Correct.
Chinese food. If you can get a takeout, that's what they're talking about.
Right.
And I will just say about General Tso's chicken, for example, very ancient General Tso, important Chinese general in 1895.
Mm-hmm.
Dish invented in New York, 1972. Sorry. So you go to China and you ask for General Tso's chicken? I don't know that you're going to get anything. Sorry.
Well, you're not going to get traditional Chinese cuisine.
Yeah.
We know that for
Chinese
sure.
Chinese secret, huh? Okay. Next topic in the news we want to clarify is our friend Kim Severson, who was on the show, mm-hmm. wrote an article about trans fat that really pointed up a very interesting problem. Trans fats created by partially hydrogenating oils are artificial trans fats, and we know for sure that these are bad for you. And there's been a lot of public outcry, and there's the trans fats have been made illegal in New York restaurants, which we don't support.
Mm-hmm.
To have trans fats labeled, we do support. However,
and it's changing. I'll tell you, forget about the restaurant law because I don't want to get into that again. But it is changing the way people are preparing our ingredients. And are trans fats the thing that's making everybody die earlier? No, they're not the thing, but they're certainly something that we know for sure is bad for us.
Well, but there's a problem. You see, in 2006 when they debated the law, the consumer groups wanted the dairy groups wanted normal trans fats that are created. Like butter has a small amount of trans fats. Most animal products have a tiny amount of trans fats. They wanted to make a distinction between natural trans fats, which we don't know whether they're bad for you or not, and the artificially created trans fats. They didn't do that. The FDA didn't make a distinction. So,
well, there have been some studies that suggest that the artificial trans fats are worse for you than
yes,
you know, but things like butter.
But there are no conclusive studies that show that the natural ones are bad for you.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is the FDA won't make a distinction. So what's happening now is people are pulling butter and eggs out of ingredients so that they can label it zero trans fats when they should be able to label it zero artificial trans fats,
right.
And that should be enough.
That's a labeling issue, and you know, some of these distinctions, what we need is some common sense. We need some
common
people
sense
with simple common sense.
Amen, brother.
To tell us what needs to go on labels, what doesn't need to go on labels, what should be illegal, what shouldn't be illegal. I just, where did that go? Where did, have we never had common sense and I'm just older now and realize it? Or has that changed?
But we're having less and less and we're driven more and more by hysteria. Look, I think that people have a right to see what's in the label. We're all about labeling.
Mm-hmm.
But we should also be able to look at the difference. What Starbucks wants now is to be able to say zero trans fats. And so they've had their bakers pull out or lower the amount of butter.
Right,
so
they have to lower the amount of butter so it goes
a number of these bakers have just taken out butter because it's not worth it because of the natural trans fats that may not be bad for you at all that appear in butter. So we're taking a product that was not using partially hydrogenated vegetable oil, it was using butter. And now they've got to pull out the butter and find trans fat-free margarine to be healthier?
So in other words, we've taken the food out of the food, and now we've added some plastics to it, so now you can eat that, and that'll be better for you.
That is a gross exaggeration, which Mark only means in jest, and we cannot be sued for it. There is no plastic in margarine. Thank you.
I didn't say there was plastic in margarine. I said we put plastic in our food.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, I think that we need a certain amount of reason here, and I think that artificially created trans fats are bad. And where they come from are partially hydrogenated oils, and they're also created when some inexpensive and sturdy oils that people used in their deep-fat fryers were heated, and that creates those trans fats,
the
artificial trans fats.
That's something that people should know about, especially those of you who own restaurants and things like that. What can happen is certain oils, when they're left in your deep fryer for too long, at too high a temperature, you will actually partially hydrogenate those oils, and you will indeed create trans fats out of oils that might be safe at lower temperatures or that you've used for less time.
All I have to say is all things in moderation, including moderation itself. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Bruce Blumberg. He is a developmental and cell biologist at the University of California at Irvine, who has recently found a link between harmful chemicals and how these chemicals can lead to obesity. These chemicals are all around us. His laboratory is broadly interested in the study of gene regulation and intercellular signaling during embryonic development, and that's really a mouthful, but we're here to explain it all to you.
Dr. Bruce Blumberg, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks
for having me.
For our listeners who don't have a scientific background, you've discovered a class of chemicals you call obesogens. What are obesogens and what do they do?
Simply put, obesogens are chemicals that promote the development of fat. So the connotation is that obesogen makes you fatter than you ought to be.
I thought that was all that extra food I ate.
Now, this works.
Everyone would like you to think.
Well, is this where did you find these obesogens, and where are they in our environment?
We found this class of chemicals when we were actually looking for something else. So we knew that these class of chemicals are called organotins, and we knew from work in Japan that these compounds had the ability to cause some amount of sex change in animals, both in snails, which is not so concerning to people, and in fishes. So we thought this must be very interesting to study, so we looked into it a little more deeply and found, to our surprise, that these same compounds also promote the development of fat.
How do they promote the development of fat? What do they give you more fat cells? Do your fat cells get bigger? What do they do?
Well, so that's one of the very important questions. What we know is that exposure to organotins when a mammal, such as a mouse, is still in the womb will make that animal become fatter later in life.
How?
The data that are available so far suggests that there are more fat cells.
So now you're talking about in utero, you're exposed to these obesogens, which is a great word, by the way. You're exposed to these obesogens, and what ends up happening is your body creates more fat cells and creates bigger fat cells?
Well, the size of the fat cell is determined by what you actually eat, but the number of cells is determined by a not completely well-understood process. So it used to be thought that you were born with all the fat cells that you would ever have, but I think that that view has now gone by the wayside, and it's appreciated that although the number of fat cells which you have is largely programmed during embryonic development, that there's the ability to change that later in life. Otherwise, you wouldn't simply be able to make people that get as large as they do. There's some unfortunate people who get to be 700, 800, 900 pounds, and that can't possibly be the result of the same number of cells just getting bigger.
Before we go any further with talking about obesogens, how they work, and the role in making people heavier, where are they found? Where in our environment might we encounter obesogens as human beings?
So the class of compounds we're talking about, organotins, are actually relatively prevalent. So they're used as fungicides on nuts and potatoes and high-value crops. They're used as catalysts for organic synthesis. And they're also a relatively abundant component of polyvinyl chloride, PVC plastics. So PVC is used for food wraps, for water pipes.
So do we find obesogens in the bloodstream of most Americans?
Such a study has not been done. The only data that are available tested a small group of people, my recollection serves, about 32. And in the blood of those 32 people, the average level of tributyltin was 27 nanomolar. That's a number that probably doesn't mean anything to the general audience, but put it in perspective, the amount that we find is required to cause fat development in mice is 20 nanomolar. So the amount circulating in human blood exceeds the amount required to have the effect that we see.
So how come it happens to some people and not to everybody?
If you think about it, let's say that organotin exposure gives you more fat cells. So that would put you at risk to gain weight, but you're not going to actually gain weight unless you fill those fat cells.
Hmm.
I seem to have succeeded at that.
At filling all your fat cells? Congratulations, Mark. That's wonderful. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and stage left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Now, with these obesogens, are these things that have been introduced into our environment in the last 30 years, 50 years, or have they been around? Have they always been around?
Well, the chemical obesogens have come into use relatively recently. So before World War II, there was very little in the way of industrial chemicals in the environment. After World War II, with the rise of synthetic chemistry and the industrialization of society, the amount of such chemicals increased dramatically. So organotins in particular came into use in the 60s and 70s. They're painted on the bottom of ocean-going ships, and they're a replacement for copper. So copper is incredibly toxic to all kinds of marine life, mostly invertebrates. It kills everything. So organotins were very much better alternative than copper because they didn't kill everything. But then people started noticing snails near harbors that had characteristics of both sexes. And these snails weren't happier. They were sterile. Mm. So that's called imposex.
So we had hermaphroditic snails created by these organotins.
Well, snails are already hermaphroditic, but what it does is it made the male sex parts larger and non-functional so that the snails weren't able to reproduce.
You found chemicals out there, classes of chemicals that can lead to obesity. Do you think they're really having a causal effect on the growing waistline of Americans?
Well, that's, of course, the most important question. So it's easy to find associations, but establishing causation is much harder, especially when we're talking about exposures that happen in the womb and effects that happen 30, 40 years later.
Now, there are different classes of chemicals. You work on one class, but there are a lot of classes of chemicals that you would classify as obesogens, things that promote greater numbers of fat cells, greater size of fat cells. Some of them are used in the food supply. How do you have any recommendations as to how one might try to avoid consuming obesogens, say, especially while pregnant?
The simplest thing is to go back to basics.
Don't eat.
Try to eat organic foods as much as you can.
Uh-huh.
That will reduce your exposure. It's going to be controversial to say this, but I would say avoid things packed in plastic.
That's controversial. That's controversial.
But that's also hard to do. I mean, how do you do that?
Well, you buy things in glass bottles, and you store your, instead of, you know, putting things in your Ziploc bags or putting them in plastic containers, you use stainless steel containers or glass containers.
Wow. And we've also talked about canned foods, you know, a lot of canned foods being lined with
Bisphenol A.
Bisphenol A. So buy frozen food if you can't.
Now, let me ask, and I think this is, look, obviously you can't state that you have a causal connection or we're all going to get sued by the plastic companies. But I just want to ask you, and this is the $64,000 question. Do you do this at home? Do you avoid plastic food that comes in plastic and the like?
As much as possible, yeah. My wife is someone who prepares lots of foods fresh. She doesn't have many things in cans. We have a few things in cans. You buy, I don't know, tomato sauce and beans and things like that. But
what are other things out there that might be in this class that we should be looking out for? We talked about bisphenol A. We talked about some of the other tributyltin and things like that. Where might we find other of these?
There's another subset of common ingredients in plastics called phthalates, which are also relatively in the news. I think that the city of San Francisco banned them.
And where might they be?
Phthalates are used to make plastic soft. So phthalates often are used in harder plastics like polyvinyl chloride to make them soft and flexible.
So where might we see that? In packaging, for instance?
In packaging. Phthalates are often used. Where else would we find phthalates? Everywhere you find PVC, phthalates are there, mm-hmm. generally speaking.
Hmm. So, a lot of our water supply comes through PVC. Is that something we should be concerned about?
Well, so that's an important question. How much of these compounds leaches from PVC? And somebody needs to determine that and whether that amount poses a risk. We generally try to reduce our exposure as much as is feasible.
Well, there you have it. Dr. Bruce Blumberg has come up with a whole new class of chemicals that we can look at and look out for. We'll link you to information on his research and articles written about him on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Dr. Blumberg, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us and explain about this fascinating new field that you have going on. We're going to link to our website so people can read more about this, more in depth about this. It's been a pleasure to have you.
You're very welcome, and thanks for having me.
Thanks very much.
Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcasts on iTunes.
And joining us on the second part of the show today is our old friend George Stakos. George, for those of you who don't know, is the founder and president of Top Shelf and The Educated Grape. Those are both companies that specialize in interactive events for organizations and educational programs and in-home wine entertaining for wine enthusiasts. He's the founder and coordinator also of the New Jersey Annual Wine and Food Classic, which is coming up. And he's an adjunct professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University's School of Hotel, Restaurant, and Tourism Management, and an old friend of ours.
George, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you, gents.
So, George, this crazy idea you had 5 years ago for the New Jersey Annual Wine and Food Classic we're going for round five here.
Yeah, round five, and it's I got to tell you, I've had the opportunity in working for several wineries to travel around and really participate in events like this around the country, and specifically on the East Coast. And residing here in New Jersey and looking and seeing, geez, wouldn't it be great for us to have, as a state, a wonderful event that really represented wines and foods from around the world? So that was really the sort of the epiphany for this. And being a fundraiser, it really raises the awareness of the hospitality industry.
So now, obviously, you know, you're the Eastern Regional Sales Manager for Quintessa Winery, which is a very famous winery from Napa Valley.
George is the Eastern Regional Manager for Quintessa Winery.
So obviously, they're going to be participating in this event. Who else is coming along to work on this with you?
Well, what's important to note, too, is people look at the name. It isn't just a New Jersey-only event. We'll have wineries from all over the world. From, you know, strong representation from California producers like Ramey and Jordan, and of course Quintessa and Stag's Leap. You know, we'll have some wonderful producers from Australia and Chile.
Let's go back to basics. Let's tell folks what happens at a food and wine festival. Now, this is Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. If people were interested to come to this thing, what would they experience if they went to, say, all 3 days? How
exactly
does it work? Most people have never been to something like this, and, you know, sometimes I think we get in the head where, of course, George, you and we have been to many things like this, but what can people expect to find?
So, again, it's a three-day event, and what we tried to do is really encompass all aspects of food and wine appreciation. So the first day focuses on wine dinners, wine and food pairings. So we'll have two dinners in different parts of the state, one being up in Bergen at Smoke Chop House, and the other will be in Scotch Plains at Stage House Restaurant and Wine Bar. Each one will be hosted by a different winery and producer. And the second day is really the signature event. That's the event where we have over 500 enthusiasts there. That's what we call the Grand Tasting on Friday evening in Madison. And that's where people just graze about and really experience, you know, over 150 wines and taste at their own pace and experience foods from 10 different restaurants. And really it's a grazing event where you're just tasting and enjoying and experimenting.
That's what we call in the business a walk-around tasting, as
That's
opposed
right.
to a seated tasting where you would sit down and someone would conduct you through a tasting. This is they're all there, and you can wander up to the table, have a taste of wine, talk to the winemaker or the person who's pouring the wine, and move at your leisure.
Yeah, it's a little more, you can do things at your own pace instead of necessarily, you know, when you go to some of the more formal tastings, frequently what I find is somebody will be either going faster than you want them to go, or they'll be going slower than you want to go.
And it's just a more formal thing, a classroom-style tasting.
When you do these walk-around tastings, it is at your pace.
Oh, exactly. And also, in addition to that, we're going to have a beautiful silent auction area, which will be focusing on some great collector, large-format bottles, and some wines that you typically couldn't find on the open market. So, but yeah, you're right. It's just a great way for people to experiment at their own pace and interest level. And for those who like that more formal setting and more of a structured educational experience, on Saturday, the third day, is a series of six seminars taking place at the Hyatt Morristown, which is about 10 minutes from Madison.
Now, what kind of seminars could people expect to find there? What things are being taught?
Well, I will be doing a vertical seminar on Quintessa, the estate from Napa Valley. We'll have a seminar focusing on discovering ice wine, specifically from Canada. We'll have a Making Sense of Pairing Wine and Food seminar, which I'll be doing with a chef.
Speaking of Making Sense of Pairing Wine and Food, you better tell people what, go back and tell people what ice wine is.
Oh, yes. Well, ice wine, the famous wine that's produced in both Germany and Canada, but wine essentially where the grapes are frozen, left frozen on the vine and harvested at that point, really focusing the flavors and concentration and sweetness of the natural sugars in the grapes. So it's a beautiful, sweet dessert-style wine.
Sorry to interrupt you there. Please continue.
And then we'll have a seminar focusing on Pinot Noir. And so really we're trying to look at trends and what people are seem to be enjoying in wine and food appreciation and really bring that in a more structured format.
And that, so would people be able to attend all six seminars, or are they held at the same time?
Well, what we do is I have a couple of packages. I have, if somebody wants to attend the Grand Tasting and the seminars, I have what I call a classic package. It's the Grand Tasting and two seminars the next day. And then if somebody just wants to do seminars, we have a seminar package, which you can attend to at a discounted price. So it's really up to the person, whatever they like. But I think the classic package really allows you to experience this walk-around, walk-around tasting and also the seminars.
George, why don't you talk to us about what something like this might cost?
So the Grand
the wine dinners and the tastings and all this.
Yeah,
things.
The wine dinner is, each restaurant's a little bit different, but it's ranging from, $75 to $110.
That's for wine and food.
That's for the sit-down dinner, if that's
right.
Per person. The Grand Tasting the next day is $60 per person, which really is an amazing value, thinking about the food and the...
Sure, that's less than you would pay for those wines at retail.
Considering that a bottle of Quintessa costs over $100 in a liquor store?
That's one way to look at it, too.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the seminars are $45 per person. So, again, if you do, for instance, the classic package, that's $130. That includes the Grand Tasting and two seminars. So it's a nice little discount.
Well, I mean, I think this is really great, and it's tremendous that you brought it to New Jersey. You said before that it was a benefit. Who's a beneficiary?
So, as you mentioned, I've been a teacher, and I teach the wine program at Fairleigh Dickinson. And, again, in starting this event, I wanted to give back to the school. So this all proceeds benefit the scholarship fund for the School of Hospitality and Tourism Management at Fairleigh Dickinson.
And it goes directly to who gets those scholarships? Are they merit scholarships? Are they need based scholarships?
Those are students who are interested in attending the school and want to pursue a career in hospitality. It really opens up opportunities for people to do that. Also opens up opportunities for people and students to travel to Switzerland and be a part of different programs there to advance their education. So it's really all about building this beautiful industry and getting people interested in it.
You know, George, as somebody who's been teaching about wine in the state of New Jersey for a long time, are you seeing the pool of people who are taking classes at places like Fairleigh Dickinson? Is that pool of people changing at all, or is it kind of been static?
Well, just to clarify, what I teach at Fairleigh Dickinson is it's a college level course, so it's essentially it's students.
Mm-hmm.
So what I love about that, it is changing a little bit. You see people, young people who've never had a glass of wine before wanting to be exposed to it because they see all the different press, whether it's just wine becoming more popular, wine becoming assisting in health and the health benefits. But what I love is teaching these students and working and traveling in the industry with wineries is a year later, 2 years or 4 years later, seeing them in the industry and actually working with them as they represent restaurants and hotels and seeing their careers blossom.
You know, we experience a very similar thing. I mean, both of our restaurants are in university towns, and we do a lot of consulting for restaurants that aren't in university towns. And so we have the great good fortune to be able to hire. I mean, Rutgers is the largest land-grant university in the United States of America. We have 40,000 students, which means every year there are 10,000 freshmen. If you can't find three good waiters in there, you have some trouble. But we hire a lot of people, and we hire without regard to experience, really. We hire the smartest, most passionate young people we can find, and often we'll get freshmen or sophomores at 18 or 19 or 20 years old who then sort of get the bug and start to learn about wine and cheese and food and start to learn about this as a profession. And it is amazing to see really intelligent young people who you know, go on. We had one of our waiters go on to be the food critic at CitySearch.com, and that was his job for 2 or 3 years and became a real powerful voice in the restaurant industry. And we have our sommelier is pursuing his master sommelier degree. It is amazing to work with young people, and it is amazing to see how it's changed among a certain cadre of young people. Don't you think, George?
Well, no doubt. And I mean, you're the history of the two of you, and I'm sure if you put together and looked at the stage left family tree of people pursuing and going on to careers in the industry, it's pretty interesting. And you're right. This is an industry where it's not you don't have to know the formula or of a certain chemistry formula. This is it's a common sense industry, and as you said, if you get the bug, whether it's for cooking or if it's for wine or if it's for service, and you have an interest and a passion, that is the key. And that's the beautiful thing about our industry, and I love that, and I love to be a part of it.
George, I have the bug. I'm looking for the cure. Is there a shot I can take? Is there something?
I was thinking the stage left family tree. I really like that. George, you would be a tree in the same wood going back. We're sort of on a cousin tree. Listen, we'll come back in just a moment and talk with our old friend, George Stakos. You can learn more about the New Jersey Wine and Food Festival, which is coming up. What are the dates, George? April 26th through 28th?
That's correct.
So it's coming up soon. You can go to njwineandfood.com. We'll, of course, put a link up on our website at restaurantguysradio.com, and you can find out more about it. If you've got the weekend free, or even if you can just go for one night, I really would check it out. We're going to talk more about the state of food in New Jersey with George Stakos in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:46.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. We're talking with our old friend George Stakos, who's a wine expert, wine educator, adjunct professor. Can't believe that, Professor Stakos. That's great. At Fairleigh Dickinson's University of Hotel and Restaurant Tourism and Management. We'll link you to how to get to his companies, the Top Shelf and the Educated Grape. They do a lot of in-home wine events and corporate wine events. We were talking about the New Jersey Wine and Food Festival, which is coming up on April 26th to 28th. You can find out more about it at njwineandfood.com. George is the founder of this event. It's in its fifth year, and it's really tremendous. George, any New Jersey wines going to be at the New Jersey Wine and Food Festival?
Absolutely. Unionville Vineyards and Amwell Valley Vineyards will be taking part in this year's event. And but Unionville, I've had a relationship with them for years, and they're always they've been a part of the event since day one, and it's great to have Amwell aboard too. So it's great to show people what's happening here in the world of New Jersey wine too.
We had a Unionville Vineyard Sauvignon Blanc on our first wine list in 1992,
wow.
1,000 years ago.
Yeah, amazing. Do you have two New Jersey wineries participate every year?
Well, Unionville's been a part of it since day one, and Amwell heard about the event and showed interest, and of course we'd love to have more on board. So it's nice. I think it's important to show people that we have some interesting wines here too.
So what's going on with New Jersey wines these days? We certainly get a lot of flack, and even on this show we give a little bit of flack to New Jersey wines. Why don't you tell us some of the good things that are happening in New Jersey wineries right now?
Well, it's just I think what's happening is they're I see some of them sticking to what New Jersey does best, not trying to force a vinifera varietal, if it's Sauvignon Blanc, as you mentioned, which was a very nice wine, or Chambersan, or some of these varietals that...
You're talking about varieties that are traditional American, North American varieties as opposed to the European varieties.
Correct, but you and I and the three of us know that those are tougher sells at the same time, so you're battling this issue of... is it a nice wine? But however, do people know what it is, and can this wine sell? But I have an interesting story. Just briefly, I do various wine classes throughout the state, and I had this one class I did. It was a blend, red blends from around the world, and I always do a mystery wine. And it's a wine that it's brown bag. Nobody knows what it is. So at the end of class, I had 7 or 8 wines from around the world, and I brown bagged a Unionville Vineyards Meritage blend. And 20 people in the room, and I asked how many people liked the wine, and about 16 of the 20 really reacted strongly to it, and I pulled the bag, and you should have saw the eyeballs go up. I mean, it's one of those things where it's, you have to taste the wine. You guys know that. You have to taste wine before you make a judgment.
Well, you know, I think it's very interesting, the situation as it stands. How do people react at the tastings when they taste the New Jersey wine side by side with the California wines and the European wines?
Well, I like to do that in a format. If and when I do that, I like to do it blind because, again, once if you see a wine on paper and you know what you're tasting, you're reacting differently to it.
I'm going to issue you an invitation. We're going to put this together. Recently, one of the things that no matter what the merits of New Jersey wines, and I think New Jersey wines have a long way to go, and while there may be some great wines produced in New Jersey, there's a lot of can we agree that there's a lot of plonk produced in New Jersey?
No doubt.
Okay. So Anthony Valenzano of Valenzano Winery in South Jersey in Chemung is suing New Jersey Life magazine, I believe it is. I'm not sure about that. But the author of the article, he's also suing Anthony Giglio, who's a mutual friend of all of us.
Yeah.
Because he said something like most New Jersey wine is plonk and has tastes of artificial fruit flavors. And I think that lawsuit's, you know, whenever you sue a critic because they don't like your stuff, and even if they make statements that you think are false, I have a problem with that. And believe me, I've been, you know, I get restaurant reviewed.
Right.
You know?
People write things that I believe are false about me all the time.
And I think you sort of, you know, I don't know.
All sour grapes, guys.
Yeah, it's a freedom of speech issue. And if critics aren't empowered to speak honestly what they feel, even if what they feel is wrong, then I feel we have a problem. But Anthony Valenzano, and I tend to agree that most New Jersey wine is plonk, which is not to say that we shouldn't support it and try and help New Jersey farmers and demand from New Jersey farmers better and better wines. I would like to sit down with you, and maybe we'll get Anthony, although he's being sued, he might not want to participate, and a few other wine experts, and we'll blind taste Jersey wines side by side with California and Washington State wines, and we'll see what the results are. And no matter what they are, we'll report it on the radio,
and we'll talk about it on this show.
What do you think?
That's a great idea. I think it's a great idea.
Okay, so here we go. We will do that. We'll report back to you in a couple of months.
We're going to put together a little tasting panel for
and,
you guys,
and we'll put some professionals together. And George is obviously very pro New Jersey wines, and we'll sit down and we'll come up with a blind tasting. That sounds like a lot of fun. Maybe we can even do it on the air.
No, we can't do it on the air.
Oh,
unless
yeah.
We tape someplace
yeah, exactly.
else.
Exactly. You can have wine on a radio station. So are you in on that, George?
I'm in. Anything you guys do to forward the goodwill of wine, I'm there.
What if we hate them? Then it'll forward the bad one.
Let's expose it.
Well, George, thanks a lot. You do tremendous work. And we're going to, like I said, we're going to link to the New Jersey Wine and Food Festival, which is coming up on April 26th to 28th. Go out there and taste some New Jersey wines, taste some other wines from around the country, and be with all the New Jersey great wine and food lovers out there. You can find it at njwineandfood.com and say hello to George Stakos. You might even see us there.
Thanks, George.
Great. Thanks, guys.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. That, you know, New Jersey Wine Festival sounds like a lot of fun, but you know what else is a lot of fun, Mark?
What else is a lot? You always scare me when you start out with something like that.
It's the No, this is a great the Coexistence Festival in New Brunswick coming up on May 5th May 6th, Saturday and Sunday.
It's going to be the first ever. Almost all the concerts are going to be free. I'm very excited about that.
Well, and the two concerts directly across the street from Stage Left. I mean, like across the street. If you're sitting around that cafe, you're in like row.
You're in the middle of it.
Are the Temptations are going to be there on the 6th, which is Sunday. And who else on Saturday?
The Indigo Girls on Saturday.
And the Indigo Girls on Saturday.
Yeah, and all the concerts throughout the city, and they'll be there are all different kinds of music.
Mayan dancers, Tibetan monks.
All kinds of different stuff. Kids group, there's a group called Starfish that plays kind of rock and roll music for kids. All throughout the whole city of New Brunswick for those 2 days is going to be a huge festival. All the concerts are free, including the Indigo Girls and the Temptations. I think the city's going to be a little crazy those 2 days.
It's going to be great. It's really going to May 5th and 6th coming up. You can find out about it at coexistencefestival.org. We will, of course, link you to it at our website.
We'll put a link up on all our websites.
And come on, have our food and listen to the Indigo Girls our food and listen to the Temptations.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put a banner to the Coexistence Festival up on the Stage Left and Restaurant Guys websites, so you guys can click right through to the Coexistence Festival and see all the different concerts that are going on. It is a huge, huge undertaking that some of the folks in New Brunswick have taken on in order to promote this great cause.
I'm flabbergasted that the Indigo Girls are going to be not in the theater next door, but in the
outside
park
playing for
across
free.
The street from us playing for free.
Playing a song in a park.
And listen, all of the seats as of now in the Sidewalk Cafe are available except for the one I'll be sitting in with a bottle of wine listening to the Indigo Girls reliving, well, the 80s.
Yeah, upstairs in Catherine Lombardi, we'll open the windows right onto the street. You'll be able to hear the whole thing.
Yeah, so if you want to find out more about that, that's coexistencefestival.org. If you can't remember that, just go to restaurantguysradio.org, and we'll link you up with a great weekend in New Brunswick.
And if you don't like the Temptations or the Indigo Girls, I advise staying out of New Brunswick that during the first weekend of May.
And the Heldrick Center, right across the street. If you don't want to park, come in the day before. Park your car at the Heldrick Center, valet park, stay overnight in our beautiful new hotel right across the street. Tell you how to do all that on our website, or just email us or call us up. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Costa.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. It's 12 noon.